it was dripping this syrup like syrup viscosity, this liquid. It was everywhere, all down, everywhere when we went down there, because there was plants and everything. It was weird. It was a purplish green color, and you could tell it was like, it was just weird. It's hard to explain. It kind of like it was like it seemed to just like be alive. I mean, it was almost like if you're looking like something organic. And I don't know. I couldn't tell. It didn't look like anything we would make, like machine parts or anything. It looked like it was sculpted.
These were these large vents. They looked like they went into the craft, but I couldn't tell. But it, I mean, it was a shadow. That was the only thing that really cast a shadow. The rest of this, well, that was another thing, was these vents cast a shadow where you could see where there wasn't light, but the sun was shining right on the object, and it didn't cast a shadow, not on anything. And it was like kind of like absorbing the light. It was weird, strange. There was no reflection or anything like that. Yeah.
Is there anything positive at all that you've gotten out of
it? Yeah, I'm still alive.
Yeah, they threw me into the mud, and all that liquid got in my hair and my face. They were like scientists, I suppose. They had this type of, we'd call it mop gear, right? Mission-oriented protective posture. And they had gas masks on and like rubber suits. And they were coming around. And you had all kinds of weird people there. Some had some version of mop or personal protective posture on, and personal protective gear, and it was all different ones, different kinds.
Very few firsthand UFO witness encounters over the decades have matched the intrigue, coherence, and respect as former U.S. Marine Lance Corporal Jonathan Weygandt. Lance Corporal Weygandt first told of his harrowing UFO crash retrieval encounter during official service in U.S. Operation Laser Strike in the Peruvian jungle through Stephen Greer in the year 2000. As a young perimeter security Marine tasked to investigate a downed aircraft thought to be a South American drug smuggling plane or friendly U.S. vehicle, the Lance Corporal claimed to have stumbled upon a crashed, egg-shaped UFO and subsequent Department of Energy retrieval team. That, in my opinion, gives us one of the greatest possible instances of insight into how U.S. government rapid reaction UFO recovery teams operate. Since his original testimony, Weygandt has publicly discussed his encounter with a non-human craft, an antagonistic DOE retrieval team, only once more. In 2023, Jonathan Weygandt appeared on a podcast with Martin Willis, readdressing aspects of the Lance Corporal's incredible encounter, but exploring little new ground. Today, I am beyond excited to announce a true successor to Jonathan Weygandt's 2000 testimony. An in-person discussion where Jonathan and myself discuss why he went public, new details of the UFO crash retrieval encounter, adverse health effects and reprisals Jonathan has faced, and so much more. Before this discussion, I thought it pertinent to take a step back and cover Weygandt's testimony in painstaking details. After all, I have covered this case before in one of my first ever projects, but barely even scratched the surface of this encounter. So before I sit down with Weygandt in the coming weeks, let's take a step back and analyze every single detail of this 1997 encounter. From piecing together the origins and deployment of the DOE recovery team, to contacting other Marines allegedly involved with the case, to determining where Weygandt may have been taken and interrogated, to analyzing specific similar egg-shaped UFO crash retrievals. Let us leave no stone unturned analyzing one of the most fascinating first-hand UFO crash retrieval cases in history. Hey guys, it's UAP Gerb, and I am thrilled for you to join me today as we embark on a comprehensive analysis of the claims of Lance Corporal Jonathan Weygandt. As a precursor to my in-person interview with Jonathan, I thought it pertinent to step back and critically analyze the entirety of his testimony. This investigation will not seek to simply retell this incredible UFO crash case, but to unravel this case and gain insights into U.S. UFO crash retrieval teams. And before we get started, a few things to point out. I would like to thank RGH UFOs and TAG OM for their incredible 2023 work into Weygandt's case. These excellent researchers arrived at many of the same conclusions I did long before this project, so please check out their work in the video description. I'll also be pulling clips from Weygandt's 2023 podcast with Martin Willis and 2000 tape testimony with Stephen Greer. And it is worthy to note, Greer chopped up Weygandt's original testimony, omitting certain details. These include Weygandt describing what looked to be a four-fingered arm hanging out of a recessed hall in the crashed UFO. Greer seemingly omitted this from the 2000 testimony. Due to this, I will be pulling Weygandt's recorded tapes off of Stephen Greer's DPI archive to try and capture Weygandt's words uncut and in their purest form. But these files are still chopped up and edited. I have found it impossible to get my hands on the full unedited tape, but this is the closest we can get. Due to these rough files, audio quality is significantly worse than the published interview, but I still find it important to publish Weygandt's words without edits. These source files contain many additional details, time spent with Weygandt's military records and drawings, as well as questions asked by filmmaker James Fox, that were curiously cut out of the 2000 published interview.
This one was the one that was half open, and you could see into it, but I mean, it was just black. It was like looking into a closet.
Where were you standing?
Alongside the 2000 tape, I have found and will be often referencing Jonathan's outreach to Greer's team from August 2000, just 2 months before his tape testimony. And of course, it goes without saying, I will often be pulling my own clips from my time spent with Jonathan Weygandt. With all that being said, let's start our investigation and first travel back all the way to 1997 to relive the experience of Lance Corporal Weygandt.
And basically, I was there, and then I was transferred over to the section for laser strike in February of 97.
As a young man, Jonathan Weygandt joined the Marine Corps in 1995 and served until 1998. After a back injury suffered in training, Jonathan's service led him to the 2nd Low Altitude Air Defense Battalion within the Marine Corps' Air Control Group 28, stationed at Marine Corps Air Station Cherry Point. During this time, Weygandt served as a low-altitude air defense gunner with training on Stinger man-portable air defense systems, man-pads, and Avenger surface-to-air missiles, SAM, platforms. In 1997, Weygandt and the USMC MACG-28 were deployed to Bucalpa, Peru to support Operation Laser Strike, specifically to operate as perimeter security for mission radar installations, and to replace aging Hawk missile batteries with Stinger and Avenger missile platforms. Laser Strike was one of numerous U.S. worldwide classified operations under U.S. Southcom or U.S. Southern Command to counter narcotics traffic in Peru. The operation included up to 20 U.S. agencies, including the USMC, Drug Enforcement Agency, Air Force, CIA, National Guard, and U.S. Army Special Forces, as well as local Peruvian forces such as Peruvian Air Force, or FAP. Laser Strike served to conduct three phases of counter-drug operations, including illegal use of airspace, alternate transportation modes, and production capabilities. Laser Strike employed several acknowledged data acquisition and radar systems to accomplish its mission, including TPS-43 and relocatable over-the-horizon radar systems, or ROTHR, and possibly covertly utilized satellites from the Defense Support Program. In 1996, Laser Strike preceded Operation Green Clover, a similar U.S. Southcom operation to combat narcotics transfer in Peru and Colombia, but much smaller in scale. In the 12-month period from April 1996 to April 97, within the timeline of Jonathan's encounter, air and ground-based radar used by Laser Strike tracked 45,000 total aircraft. 5,390 of these were quote-unquote tracks of interest. Only 150 of these were suspected of drug trafficking, but only 21 such planes were forced or shot down. However, the exact number of shootdowns was classified. Three primary locations satisfied this mission conducted in Peru: Pucallpa, Andoas, and Iquitos, whose mission was to track, identify, and ground by warning or force drug trafficking aircraft entering or leaving Peruvian airspace. In support of Laser Strike and counter-drug operations, U.S. Special Forces were additionally sent to Iquitos, Peru, to the Mar Forlant Riverine Training Team to train with Peruvian military forces. U.S. Southcom authorized up to 14 Special Forces deployments to the region during 1997, and one major Special Forces group that aided in South American counter-drug operations attached to U.S. Southcom was the U.S. Army 7th Special Forces Group, aka the U.S. Army Green Berets, out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Historically, the 7th Special Forces out of SOCOM, or Special Operations Command, within the 1st Special Forces Command had previously been deployed in Operation Snowcap. a drug enforcement agency counter-narcotics operation in 9 Latin American countries alongside the U.S. Navy SEALs. The Army's 7th Special Forces Group has conducted foreign internal defense, counter-drug, and training missions in Central and South America. The 7th specializes in unconventional warfare, direct action, special reconnaissance, counter-proliferation of WMD, or Warheads of Mass Destruction, and Security Force Assistance. Why all this discussion of Green Berets and Special Operations Command units attached to Laserstrike? Recall how quite often I discuss the involvement of Special Operations Command or their Elite Component Command JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, in UFO crash retrieval operations. Well, this will all become apparent quite soon when discussing Weygandt's retrieval encounter. Up to his involvement in Laserstrike, Jonathan had no interest in the subject of UFOs, but his worldview was somewhat shaken during his guard station performing perimeter security at his Laserstrike radar installation. Weygandt would state in the command center of the radar installation he would overhear USAF personnel discussing aircraft tracked flying in and out of the atmosphere at Mach 10+.
I knew that these aircraft were flying because I had been in the command center there at the radar installation, and I heard a couple women there in the Air Force talking about aircraft flying in and out of the atmosphere at Mach 10+. So these aircraft are flying around there, they're re-entering the atmosphere or whatever, and they're talking about, well, we got these aircraft flying again. And the other girl says, yeah, they're coming in and out of the atmosphere. Are those our stuff? And so those are our aircraft? And they're like, well, I can't remember what she said.
Weygandt would even state an Air Force colonel would enter the command center about 30 minutes after this conversation and confiscate logbooks tracking flight data.
I'm not sure, but I think these logs did contain those tracks. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken them. And we're talking about, there's hundreds, thousands of aircraft flying through there, weekly. And all these logs, they're writing them in. And they're writing how many times certain aircraft are, they get certain vectors for aircraft that are supposed to be around. And I mean, when you got objects that are re-entering the atmosphere and then stopping on a dime and then turning around and going exactly the opposite direction, that's kind of strange. Meteors don't do that.
Oh, is this something that was rare or something that was happening?
Oh, this happened all the time. There was like 3 or 4 incidents where I was duty there that the same Air Force officer came in there to get books.
And do you think these were tracked on radars?
These were tracked from this particular radar that were logged in. The reason, I guess they were taking them is they didn't want people to know that they're tracking these aircraft. I guess, I'm just assuming that.
One night while on guard duty at around 11 p.m. to midnight between April and March 1997, Weygandt was approached by Staff Sergeant Montalegre, Sergeant Allen, and Sergeant Adkins and told that there was a downed aircraft, possibly friendly, and that he and other Marines were needed to secure the crash site. By 3 to 4 a.m., Jonathan, Adkins, and Allen were in the vanguard of a group of Humvees among 8 to 10 Marines sent to secure the crash area. After a combination of driving and trekking through the jungle, the Marines reached the site around 6 to 7 a.m.
And they came to us and said, look, we got a situation where we have an aircraft crash that's possibly friendly, and they need us to go and secure the crash site. And we're like, fine. So this is late at night. I know, about 11 or 12 at night. And I was on guard duty that night, so I was already up, and it was my shift. We have 12-hour shifts, 12 on, 12 off, and where we rotate our section. So we all went out that night. We got up, 3 or 4 in the morning and headed out in Humvees. We had about 5 or 6 Hummers, and we drove to where we needed to go, and then we had to hump through the bush. So we got there, 6, 7, just when daylight had just started to get light. And, we found the area really easy because there was a huge gash in the land where something had crashed. And it didn't break anything. I don't know if you've ever been to a crash site where, you had trees, just broken like in half. Everything was burned, and it was like if you had almost cut like a warm butter with a knife. I mean, it was just, it's like something on fire or had energy or some kind of energy, like a laser almost had like gutted. I mean, it was really strange. And,
Anyway, I was in the front with Sergeant Allen and Sergeant Atkins. We were up front, and we were point, basically, and we were like, I don't know, 10, 20 meters ahead of everyone else. We all had maps and radios and compasses, so we knew so we wouldn't get lost. And basically, we were the first ones to see the object. And basically what happened is we didn't go straight up the hill, because basically this thing went up the hill and then off into the side of the ravine or the ridge. This is about a 200-foot ridge, at least. Solid granite. I mean, it's rock. I don't know if it's granite. It's just, it was buried in the side of a cliff. But anyway, we didn't go straight up. We went to the left and walked up to the top of the ridge. And that's when we saw the craft.
But, I mean, it had landed and cut its way through the jungle and embedded itself in I don't know what you would call it, almost like a saddle or one of these kind of foothills. It's kind of a ridge, and it went into the side of it. And I can't remember how far from the initial impact that when it landed, it actually physically hit the deck and then went in. I don't know how far down it was. Yeah, man, it burned itself like into the deck. You know, like a foot or two, I don't know. It was deep.
The terrified and confused Marines climbed down the ridge to get closer to this object, with Weygandt getting the closest of all the Marines. Weygandt, Allen, and Adkins observed a huge ship embedded at a 45-degree angle into the rocky cliff face.
This is the craft. This is pretty crude two-dimensional drawing, but this is jungle here, and this was the craft, and it was embedded in the rock like this, and I'm not sure if this tapered off or how it went, but these right here are the hatches, these two objects here. This one was the one that was half open, and you could see into it, but, I mean, it was just black. It was like looking into a closet.
Where were you standing?
Damage, I think, from the missile. And these were these large vents. They looked like they went into the craft, but I couldn't tell. But, it was a shadow. That was the only thing that really cast a shadow. The rest of this, well, that was another thing. Was these vents casted a shadow where you could see where there wasn't light, but the sun was shining right on the object, and it didn't cast a shadow, not on anything. And it was like kind of like absorbing the light. It was weird, strange. There was no reflection or anything like that.
The object was a massive metallic egg or teardrop shape measuring 10 meters in height and 20 meters in length.
Probably like 3 or 4... standard 53-foot trailers wide, and about three, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So about 16 of those together. So it was pretty big, man. It was
catastrophic damage, likely leading to the crash of the vehicle, was visible. No debris littered the area, but Weygandt observed an enormous gash in the rear of the craft. Jonathan guessed this damage to be from Hawk MiM-23 missile batteries. Although Hawk systems were phased out of military use in 1994, the USMC maintained usage until 2002. However, Weygandt guessed the Hawk system used to down the craft was used by the Peruvian Air Force. This being because the USMC phased out Hawk missiles from laser strike in early 1997. Though he has no direct knowledge, to this day, Weygandt, after extensive studying of MiM-23 ballistics, believes Hawk fragmentation missiles caused the damage and downing of the craft.
Yeah, well, what I think happened, I think a lot of that fragmentation, like, went into the craft and, like, bounced around, right, after it got hit and as it was going down. So it probably didn't come out. But like I said, if the missile had hit it, depending on, you know, what the craft was made of and depending on the speed of the missile and its angle and all that, I think it probably would have penetrated and exploded, and it would have just disintegrated the ship totally. Yeah.
This then presents a unique question. How could a conventional missile down a highly advanced non-human craft? Similar intriguing incidents, like a quote-unquote one-in-a-million targeting of a teardrop-shaped UFO by a naval destroyer in 1973, was discussed in my last project on naval legacy programs. MiM-23 Hawk missiles are unique. Hawks are not only able to utilize conventional missiles, but also airburst rounds, which explode near, not on a target, to damage enemy personnel or vehicles with devastating fragmentation. Perhaps a conventional missile could never hit a moving UFO, but perhaps in this case, a Hawk MiM-23 got just close enough to frag and down a target. But let's get back to the wreckage. The best way Wigant could describe the craft was metallic but organic, almost as if it was alive. The object did not appear as if it was made of machine parts, but more sculpted. The craft was purplish-green and fluctuating in color, almost like gasoline on water. This effect is known as the mother of pearl effect, and the changing colors would sometimes even make the craft near translucent.
Well, I thought at one point it looked half like green and half purple, and then it was changing the image of the physical properties of it, how it was constructed or whatever. But that there was some kind of field on it, and it was going, like I said, with Greer. It was like, you know, when you wash your car with, fluid, right, with like palm olive or whatever, a dish detergent. And when it bubbles up, it gives like the color chemical rainbow. It was like that, but all over the craft. And it was kind of like moving around weird.
So it wasn't staying just, one color?
No. It was kind of like moving around and going, sometimes it would go like completely like almost like silver, right?
The disabled craft was dripping a liquid with the viscosity of syrup. This liquid had poured all over the surrounding foliage.
And that hatch that was ajar or busted open, broke open, that's where the liquid seemed to come from, right? And it seemed to come out of there, and it was f-ing everywhere, man.
Could you describe it for us?
It was clear. Well, no. Whatever that stuff was, I don't know what to call it, the fluid, it was clear, like just, you know, water clear.
The fluid was clear?
Yeah.
But it was viscous, like...
Yeah, but it was thick like maple syrup.
A large sweeping light traveled around the circumference of the vehicle that slowed until the vehicle seemingly powered off. Along with this sweeping light, Wigant could hear the craft dimming until it went silent. Wigant described the sound as a guitar amplifier.
There was one light on it that slowly went around, and the machine, I could hear it, I guess, because it was still functioning, and it had like a hum to it, like a really bass, like say if you unplugged an amp from a guitar, that kind of, it was really, it was really deep.
But it was loud, man. It was like a deep, rap. It would have been like several orders of magnitude louder than, you know, the real deep bass rap, boom, 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 right? It was like boom, it was woo, woo, like this, but it was more like a, I don't know, man, I just can't describe it. It's not even like that, man, it's just indescribable.
It was that light cycling.
It's almost sounded like a chemical sound, man. Like wow. A chemical, like watery kind of like sound, man, like you're, it's weird.
And that light was slowing down, right?
Yeah, it finally stopped, right? Everything, like, shut off.
This sound of a guitar amp is almost identical to the testimony of former Marine Michael Herrera, who described the same sound emanating from an 8-gon alien reproduction vehicle. As Jonathan got closer to the craft, he was able to make out more surface detail, such as the craft not being smooth, but featuring what looked to be notches and bumps. 50 to 100 yards away from the craft, Jonathan got the mysterious liquid all over what Marines call camis or battle dress uniform. The liquid discolored his camis like acid and ate Jonathan's skin.
So you got within like 150 to 300 feet of this.
Right.
But this thing was so high up on the cliff face, you got some of this liquid on you.
Yeah, it was everywhere, man.
And what did it do to you? What did it do to your clothes?
Well, I mean, they took my clothes, but my hair on my legs went away and it's never really come back. I lost all my hair on my legs.
Determined yet frightened, the young Lance Corporal maintained his gaze on this incredible ship. The crashed vehicle additionally featured large vents on the freestanding side Wigant described similar to fish gills. Though he could only see one side of the craft, Jonathan wagered these same gills he guessed were used for propulsion were featured on the other side of the craft.
Yeah, on the part of it. Looked like, I don't know what it was, but yeah, it had sort of like these... And they're a really tight kind of like ellipse that ran down the side, like got small, got progressively smaller.
And
I only saw it like a couple of freaking times because it was the weird, I don't know what it was. All I could say, it was like some type of force shield. I don't know what it was.
Three seemingly non-flush hatches sat near the top of the craft, one of these hatches being half open. Although no lights were visible from behind the hatch, Weygandt did observe what appeared to be a four-fingered arm hanging limply from the open hatch. This element of Weygandt's testimony was seemingly cut from his 2000 interview, with Weygandt confirming to me that it must have indeed been cut, as he did inform Greer of this arm.
Yeah, one of the creatures was, his arm and hand was hanging out. He was hanging out.
Did it come out? Was it hanging out when you walked up to it? Or was
yeah, he was hanging out, probably dying. I don't know about the other pilot. I don't know what they were, to be honest with you, but I guess you could call them aliens or whatever. I guess that would be.
Yeah.
Right. And one of them was, I think he was dying almost or close to death, right, from the crash. So, but I, like I said, this is what I thought at the time. I mean, I don't know.
This detail is very interesting, as I am reminded of the 1965 Kecksburg, Pennsylvania crash retrieval encounter where multiple eyewitnesses described biologics inside the bell-shaped craft whose appendages were visible once a craft hatch had opened and the vehicle was depressurized.
So you and two sergeants, kind of who led the vanguard, got the closest to the craft, but you got the closest, right?
Right, I was the closest to it.
And the other two sergeants were kind of standing a little bit off while you got closer to the craft. And
because I ran up to it.
Was there anything weird about your guys' compasses, comms?
Yeah, all of that was all, you know, it wasn't working.
So your compass, was it just going haywire?
Yeah, it was spinning around.
Around the same time, Jonathan felt like a presence was reaching out to contact him.
You got a clear sense that there were some kind of life forms?
Yes, there was life forms and the ship. It's almost like if someone was like reading your mind, and that's the way it felt. I felt like I felt a presence, just like supernatural, you know. I felt this presence that and it's real strange. I guess it was almost like, I think the creature, I told Leslie this, I thought the creatures were, they conned me, and it was like weird. I think they were trying to communicate with me, like, I guess telepathically. It's really weird, and I don't believe in it. And any of that stuff, but anyway, it was, I could hear, like, and it was terrible because it kept going, and then it still comes and goes. It's like basically sitting in your car and turning on like an AM station that's not, you know, it's just white noise and it's turning it up really high. And that's what I heard when I first got in there. And I didn't ask any of the other guys that I was with if they heard that or anything.
Jonathan was mesmerized by this presence. He felt the creatures were informing him that everything would be all right, but were also requesting his help. He was so spellbound, he ignored the cries and cussings of Sergeants Allen and Adkins, who stood away from the craft, shouting at Weygandt not to get any closer.
They were scared, and it was the apprehension, the fear, and then that they were not here to harm us. That's really what it felt like. And I mean, that's not my own emotions. That was something that they were projecting towards me, like if somebody was shining like a spotlight on me. That's what I felt. They were directing their thoughts at me. I mean, this is not. I mean, I didn't think about all this at the time, but it's been occurrences where I've seen the creatures in my thoughts, and I saw them what they looked like, and they projected, and I didn't tell Leslie this either. It was the grays basically, and I'm not just saying that, but I never really was into the UFO stuff, and I didn't read books on when I was a kid. But basically, the oval egg head with big dark eyes, big eyes, a nose and a small mouth, new ears.
I think I've had, you know, dreams of them, and I don't but I didn't see them, but. They were not the small, you know, small kind, like 3 or 4 foot, right? They were huge.
Yeah, you said these were tall, like 8 to 10 feet.
Yeah, they were huge, yeah.
What were their heads like? Like classic gray aliens?
Yeah, classic, but really like elongated, kind of coming up like this, and they'd have been probably this big.
Like a balloon?
Yeah, no. Like the kind of like the more oblong shape, not like the classic. If you look at Communion, right?
The Whitley Strieber?
Right, but the artwork they have on there, they would not have been fat like that. They were more skinnier, but they were also like on a kind of a skinny heart.
And they were projecting that they weren't here. They were here.
They were here to, they weren't, you know, that they were not going to harm me. And that was basically that everything is going to be all right. Just help us get out of here. I think there were, I don't know how many were on the craft.
Yeah, since more than one.
Yeah, definitely more than one. Probably about four or five. I don't know. Not a large number.
The communication from the occupants of the craft, as well as the appearance of the craft, led Jonathan to believe this vehicle was controlled via thoughts. With the massive discussion of psionics here in 2025, through the testimony of Jake Barber and Skywatchers, this early mention of basically psionics in 2000 by Weygandt is extremely interesting. Additionally, I have discussed before, dating all the way back to the 1950s, stories and testimonies of UFOs being controlled with consciousness, headband transceivers, or unique control mechanisms. To learn more about this subject, I do recommend checking out my video on the claims of Colonel Philip J. Corso. After about 15 to 20 minutes at the site, Weygandt and the other Marines embarked to climb back up the ridge to rendezvous with the rest of the MACG-28 Marines when they were greeted by 2 to 4 Army CH-47 helicopters flying overhead preparing to land in a nearby clearing. When Jonathan and the others climbed to the top of the gorge, the Marines were quickly intercepted by armed men dressed in black fatigues styled similarly to a SWAT team.
It was almost like they were there already. They were on the ground already, and whoever was flying over was coming in after these guys had landed. So I'm not sure where they landed, where they were, but they were just there on top of us, like within a few minutes.
And so,
I can't remember exactly how.
It's speculation on your part. You don't know for sure, but you think it's possible that team may have been there first.
Yeah, they were definitely there first, and they were monitoring us too. I'm sure they knew we were in the area when we got up there near it. But they looked Army, but they didn't have, insignia on them, right? They were same color and all this.
These men spoke with American dialects, but bore no insignia, patches, or identification. The men were older, in their late 30s and 40s, and immediately showed signs of extreme hostility and aggression.
Black BDUs, right? What the Army would call BDUs, like our camis, right? They're like our fatigues, but they would have been totally black.
Totally black.
Like sure.
And they had helmets on?
No, the guys that were on the deck, no, they had they had boonie caps, and they had the soft Army covers, round Army covers.
Do you remember what kind of weapons they had? Was it better than the kind of the Marines had?
No, I think they had MP3s and Glocks and shotguns.
Okay. So.
And I think maybe there was a few M16s. I mean, this has been a long time. They had mini guns on the 47s.
So the CHs actually
had. They had mini guns on the side. Yeah.
Did they have a man at the gun?
Yeah, they had a man, and he was wearing like this skull type of freaking helmet, man. It's fucking really wicked. Yeah, it looked satanic. Yeah.
So when this team encountered you guys, did they have their weapons trained at you? Were you held at gunpoint?
Oh yeah.
And so they immediately start. Do they strip you guys of gear? Do they rough you up?
Yeah,
do they take your IDs?
We were. Setting our gear up and taking them out and throwing it out and emptying all our pockets and everything.
Later in our investigation, we will devote a significant amount of time to attempt to track down the origin of this team, so sit tight for a little bit. Having the jump on the Marines, the unknown operators stripped Weygandt, Allen, and Adkins of their gear and weapons. The young Lance Corporal took a swing at one of the men, cracking him on his head. For his transgressions, Jonathan was beaten, restrained, and forced to lie down face down on the jungle floor, getting even more of the strange liquid on him. During this scuffle, a team of near 30 began departing the landed CH-47 helicopters. This team featured individuals in rain jackets bearing 3 letters, Delta, Oscar, Echo.
Oh, they were like scientists, I suppose. They had this type of, we'd call it mop gear, right? Mission-oriented protective posture. And they had gas masks on and like rubber suits. And they were coming around. And you had all kinds of weird people there. Some had some version of mop or personal protective posture on and personal protective gear. And it was all different ones, different kinds.
DOE is, of course, the acronym for the infamous Department of Energy, the successor to the Atomic Energy Commission, whose 1954 Atomic Energy Act historically served as a monolith to misclassify UFO materials and data as quote-unquote transclassified foreign nuclear information.
Is there any indication the Department of Energy is involved in UAP data collection and housing?
I don't have an answer.
I can't confirm or deny that in a public setting.
No. Could you do it in a secure setting?
Yes.
The DOE really needs no introduction. Whether it's my work, the reporting of Chris Sharp, or the words of David Grush, the DOE is almost always mentioned as a primary pillar of UFO legacy program operations. Key in my work are the numerous implications of the DOE's FFRDCs, or Federally Funded Research and Development Centers, such as Lawrence Livermore National Labs, Los Alamos National Labs, Sandia National Labs, and DOE contractors, such as Triad National Security, one-third of which is run by Battelle Memorial Institute's direct involvement in technologies of unknown origin exploitation programs. And similar to the seasoned operators, soon in this video we will attempt to track down exactly what this DOE team was, where they were stationed, and more. In addition to the people in Department of Energy rain jackets, the team featured members dressed in biological containment suits donned with DOE lettering. Weygandt described these as similar to spacesuits.
It wasn't like that. It was more high-tech, like those big jumpsuits that you zip up the back and you can like wear a breathing apparatus in there. Those guys, there was about 30 of them at least, and they marched right by me as I was being taken away. They were marching to get down into the cliff. I guess they were in there to check this thing out.
These suits mentioned remind me closely of myriad crash retrieval team testimonies I have covered in the past, and I am immediately reminded of eyewitness accounts to the 1965 Kecksburg, Pennsylvania UFO crash, where witnesses claimed that men in quote-unquote moon suits carried boxes and equipment into the crash site.
A little while later, there was a large truck pulled in, a light-colored truck, box van type. Out of it, there was four guys come out. They had what we call moon suits at the time. They were white coverall type suit. They took a box out of there, box maybe 4 or 5 foot square. They carried down four handles, and they carried that down to the object. About just right after that, there was a military man.
After being restrained and beaten by the operators, Jonathan was stripped to his underwear by the men in containment suits before having his feet bound and was handcuffed to a stretcher.
Did the other two sergeants have any liquid on them?
No, not that I remember. I'm the only one I think got hit with all that because they did not go up under the craft and in the very close immediate vicinity of it.
At this time, Weygandt was separated from Allen and Adkins and taken aboard one of the team's helicopters.
No, they said that, you know, that I was, they were cussing at me saying that I was a why don't you people ever, you know, pay attention to orders. You weren't supposed to be there and you're not supposed to see this. And you're going to be dangerous if we let you go and all this stuff. Yeah. I mean, I thought they were going to kill me. Really? I thought, man, I'm finished, dude.
Weygandt was flown to a base different than his deployment site. This location featured significantly more permanent structures than his radar site, and Jonathan guessed this was partially a Peruvian military installation. Curiously, here Weygandt observed not just Americans on site, but many nationalities.
There's a lot of other nationalities there. Chinese, Germans, I think, were there. I mean, a lot of other people were at this other base. But, I mean, this thing was really, I mean, I didn't go in and all they did was take me to like a, you couldn't call it a cell. It was more of like a, it was more like an interrogation room. And I sat in there for, I don't know, 15 hours.
Yeah, they were mercs, man. That was the other thing. Cause a lot of those dudes didn't, there was two Chinese dudes there that I remember. They spoke very little English.
But they were in.
The German spoke perfect English, right?
They were in military fatigues.
Yeah, same, black. Black cameras.
Do they have weapons?
Yeah, pistols. I would assume that they were Glocks, but I couldn't see them because they're the standard U.S. pistol, like, and it covers it up.
They were holstered on the hip.
Yeah, right.
So these guys, by their black camis, may have been from the same team.
Yeah, I was looking at them, and they yelled at me not to look at them. Look at them. I didn't think they wanted me to remember them. That's what why they did that.
From what you could see, what were they doing? Were they just kind of at general station?
Yeah,
they...
just whatever they were doing. I don't know what they were doing, mm-hmm. Whatever.
I have a strong thesis of where this location might be, and we will discuss this soon. Weygandt was not taken into a cell or forced into isolated barracks, but was instead taken underground and sequestered in an interrogation room where he was contained for up to 2 days. During this hellacious stay, Jonathan was interrogated and tormented by one of the operators who detained him.
And I couldn't really readily identify any of these guys, but I knew one of them was at the crash site, because they were one of the guys that I recognized, because he was in black fatigue, and he's like, "What'd you see?" And he's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Growling." You know, he goes, "Are you a patriot? You like the Constitution?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Well, we do it. You know, we're on our own program. You know, we don't obey. We just do what we want." And he's like, "Yeah." And they're like, and they're growling and they're relishing, you know, and they're yelling at me and they're hollering and cursing. You didn't see anything, you know, and we'll do you and your whole family. And they're, you know, it was basically that for about 8 or 9 hours. I mean, they took breaks. Basically, they were like, "Look, man, we're gonna take you off in a helicopter and just kick your ass out in the jungle. And you're just gonna, we're gonna end you and all this." And they didn't physically put their hands on me, but I was sitting in a chair and I was handcuffed in the chair and I couldn't move. So basically, you know, it was just this like harassment.
Towards the end of his confinement, a lieutenant colonel from the Air Force visited Weygandt. This colonel bore no name tag, nor did he disclose his identity. The colonel threatened Weygandt's life repeatedly, telling him this clandestine operation would have no trouble leaving Weygandt dead in the jungle. The colonel then made Weygandt sign multiple documents, securing his silence on his incredible yet horrific encounter.
And he told me, you know, if we just took you out in the jungle, you know, they'd never find you out there. And I'm like, and you know, I didn't want to say, you know, I didn't want to test him to see if he'd really do that. So I said, "Yeah." And he's like, "You got to sign these papers. And you never saw this. And I don't exist. And this situation never happened. And if you tell anybody, you'll just come up missing." And he was a real abrasive, just a cynical, I guess the best way to put it. And what papers? Well, they were. It was the standard form that you signed. It's almost like a waiver. I don't know. I'd probably be able to identify another paper like that. I guess it's for if you've seen something you're not supposed to, you're just signing that you didn't see it or whatever. Just basically a security form, I believe. And there was two of those that I signed. And then after that, I was driven back to my base.
Jonathan was finally driven back to his original radar installation. This is a key point here for our upcoming investigation. Weygandt was in close enough proximity to be driven back to the original base and not flown.
I don't remember leaving though, but I know I went out because they put a mask over me. I had a mask over me when I got to the base. They put it on before I got out of the helicopter. And when I left from where I was, where they held me, they put one on. I mean, it had something open where I could breathe, but I couldn't see and I couldn't hear. And they brought me out and they took me to this flat line.
Jonathan was segregated with USAF personnel at his original base for 3 weeks before being sent back to Cherry Point. While there, Jonathan had no opportunity to contact Allen, Adkins, or the other Marines. By May of 97, while still in service, Jonathan became tormented by the event, experiencing horrific nightmares, missing time, and weird dreams. None of these symptoms had occurred before witnessing the crash. To this day, Jonathan maintains there were internal USMC attempts to make him appear unstable and an unreliable witness. By late 97, Jonathan confessed to using banned substances so he could be discharged by the Marines. Around this time, MACG-28 and the Criminal Investigation Division made his life horrific, and by March of 1998, Weygandt was discharged. Now let's move over to investigating the retrieval encounter in extreme detail, an attempt to break down every single detail of this retrieval.
After we climbed back up, I think the DOE, Department of Energy people were there. They knew about it, and I don't know why we went there still to this day. But anyway, I was arrested. I had all my gear taken from me by men in black camis, had no name tags. They were older men, probably in their late 30s or 40s. I got in a little scuffle with them, and I hit one of them. I took a swing at one of them, and I hit him in the forehead.
They had the big D, you know, Delta Oscar Echo on the back of their back, and a couple of the guys were wearing like these rain jackets because it had been raining the previous day, and they were in there, and there were other guys that were wearing containment like biological suits. It wasn't like that. It was more high tech, like those big jumpsuits that you zip up the back and you can, like, wear a breathing apparatus in there. Those guys, there was about 30 of them at least, and they marched right by me as I was being taken away. They were marching to get down into the cliff. I guess they were in there to check this thing out.
On their black uniforms, was there any sign of rank?
No rank.
Okay.
No name tapes, none of that.
But when you encountered these guys, was there any semblance that there was a hierarchy?
There was definitely hierarchy.
The team leader, was he an aggressive one or?
Oh, they were all aggressive. I don't know, man, to be honest with you.
Could you gauge the temperament of the DOE team? Did they seem to focus on the mission? What?
No, they were kind of like power mad, going crazy, running around.
Swarming like rats.
Yeah.
Do they have any equipment?
Yeah, I don't know what it was.
Before we investigate, let's quickly review Jonathan's encounter with this unknown military and scientific team near the crash site. Ignoring cries of danger by Sergeant Allen and Sergeant Adkins, Lance Corporal Weygandt cut only 15 to 20 minutes at the crash site before 2 to 4 U.S. Army CH-47 Chinooks began to land in the nearby Hasty LZ. Climbing out of the ravine, the Marines were met by operators in black camis, featuring no insignia or identification. These operators, who spoke with American dialects, likely arrived prior to the teams in the CH-47s and disarmed and apprehended the Marines. Being a rambunctious young soldier, Weygandt took a swing at one of the clandestine operators, connecting his fist with the man's head. These rogue operators restrained Jonathan and forcefully laid him face down on the ground, where he got more of the strange, clear, syrupy liquid on him. While Jonathan was being restrained, a group of maybe 30 began walking from the landed CH-47s down into the crash site in the ravine. The personnel were comprised largely of men in rain jackets marked Delta Oscar Echo, or DOE, aka the Department of Energy. Alongside these men were multiple individuals in suits and hazmat gear Jonathan described as mission-oriented protective posture, or MOP gear. Jonathan was forced to strip to his underwear, discarding the clothes covered in the mysterious liquid by the suit-clad DOE personnel before having his hands cuffed, feet bound, and he was then carried onto a stretcher to one of the CH-47s. Jonathan was not taken aboard with Sergeant Adkins and Sergeant Allen, but instead isolated and forcefully taken to an unknown camp. Let's pause here and break this down. Jonathan's mention of DOE assets in the Peruvian jungle gives us some extremely actionable data points. Remember, Weygandt and his fellow Marines learned about the crash between 11 p.m. and midnight, departed to investigate around 3 to 4 a.m., and arrived to the crash site around 6 to 7 a.m. From intelligence to arrival, the Marines took a maximum of 8 hours. In roughly the same time span, plus maybe an extra hour or two, if the Department of Energy was privy to advanced signals intelligence of the UFO being targeted, possibly by Peruvian Hawk MiM-23 missile batteries, the DOE was able to mobilize American personnel, assets, and containment suits to secure the crash area. This would imply the recovery team was highly organized and likely a rapid reaction recovery unit. This unit was able to plan, mobilize, execute, and contain a UFO crash retrieval site within roughly 8 to 9 hours. Remember back to my work on USO retrievals and the deep submergence rescue vehicle under Project Sand Dollar. Such submersibles were deployable anywhere in the world within 72 hours. This 30-plus man team was able to deploy and react to Peru in roughly 11% of that 72 hours. In numerous videos in the past, I have spoken about UFO crash retrieval rapid recovery units. Whether this be the USAF Blue Berets, allegedly on site for the 1965 Kecksburg, Pennsylvania crash retrieval, the Blue Boys rapid retrieval and transport helicopter units relayed to Leonard Stringfield, or the rapid response USAF unit first on site to the 1953 Kingman, Arizona crash, stories of highly structured and efficient dedicated UFO recovery units are inseparable from UFO crash retrieval testimonies. In fact, Weygandt's description of the on-site team reminds me extremely closely of an enigmatic, brutal, and perplexing UFO crash recovery case I have covered before in extreme detail, the 1974 Coyame, Mexico UFO crash retrieval. This case has very little in the form of evidence-based paper trails, but outlines an incredible and logical crash retrieval encounter. In this case, U.S. intelligence agencies, specifically the CIA, monitored a UFO from the Gulf of Mexico that, after a series of jagged and abrupt turns, crashed into the northern Chihuahua part of Mexico. According to the primary source document of this case, the allegedly leaked Deneb report, the CIA mobilized a rapid recovery unit out of Fort Bliss, Texas. This team arrived on site from four unmarked helicopters, including UH-1 Hueys and CH-53 Super Stallions equipped with hazmat gear. Hazmat or MOP gear was required at this crash site, according to the Deneb report, because of a hull containment breach of toxic materials, gas, or liquid out of the UFO that subsequently killed the Mexican military retrieval team. There is, of course, an argument the U.S. Rapid Recovery Team killed these Mexican soldiers, but that is not our topic. Let's remain in 1974 to attempt to uncover the origins of this DOE team. This year saw the creation of the Department of Energy and National Nuclear Security Administration's Nuclear Emergency Support Team, formerly known as the Nuclear Emergency Search Team, aka NEST. Previously, I have labeled NEST as the on-site retrieval science team Weygandt encountered in the jungles of Peru in 1997, just like other excellent researchers like RGH UFOs did before me. Today, however, I have even stronger conviction NEST handled the recovery of a non-human vehicle and hazardous containment breach of a mysterious liquid suffered by a young Marine during Operation Laser Strike. But what is this NEST? NEST, or Nuclear Emergency Support Team, was created under Executive Order 12656. NEST was founded as a DOE-specialized nuclear emergency organization that assisted the FBI and numerous government agencies by, quote, providing technical expertise and advice in response to a variety of potential incident threats involving nuclear materials, end quote. Analyzing a 1996 NEST briefing, the closest available document to the time of our crash, NEST engaged in myriad deployment activities, serving as an Operational Emergency Management Team, or OEMT, and also as a threat credibility assessor, ensuring NEST was the quote-unquote initial party to the scene. On mission deployment sites, NEST would restrict access, perform diagnostics and threat mitigation actions, agency planning and coordination, as well as handle disablement and cleanup. In short, NEST operated as an umbrella organization to handle all nuclear and radiological emergencies for the Department of Energy. The mission of NEST is to be, quote, prepared to respond immediately to any type of radiological accident or incident anywhere in the world, end quote. Around 1996, NEST enjoyed its own arsenal of vehicles, including high-tech vans, MBB BO-105 helicopters, and numerous jets, including Cessna Citation IIs, that featured a max speed of 464 miles per hour, and remember that speed, as it will become quite important later on. Now, it is crucial to mention, NEST personnel did not consist of armed operators. Therefore, it is safe to assume the operators in black camis were not NEST operators. Though it is possible they were still DOE assets. We will get to that soon. Personnel in NEST circa 1996 included chemists, engineers, health physicists, management and logistics personnel, nuclear physicists, analysts, etc. The corporate team members of the Nuclear Emergency Support Team consisted of some familiar faces to this channel. NEST forces have historically been comprised of contractors rather than the Department of Defense. Not only did NEST partner with Raytheon, but also EG&G, Los Alamos National Labs, Sandia National Labs, and Lawrence Livermore National Labs. As we discussed earlier, a cornerstone of my work is discussing the missing link of U.S. government corporate UFO legacy programs. The subject matter expert Federally Funded Research and Development Centers, or FFRDCs, alongside institutions like the MITRE Corporation, RAND Corporation, Center for Naval Analyses, Los Alamos, Sandia, and Lawrence Livermore National Labs operate as FFRDCs for the U.S. Department of Defense. Sandia and Lawrence Livermore were also directly accused by USAF Master Sergeant Edgar Fouché as engineering the propulsion devices from the reverse-engineered triangular craft, the TR-3B. I have also discussed Sandia National Labs as implicated in UFO technology transfer with AT&T and Bell Labs, as well as serving as a UFO legacy program location to house craft and biologics, as outlined in the disputed Majestic 12 and Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit documents. And a quick side note, while these documents I just mentioned may be disputed, the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit was proven to exist through FOIA requests done by UFO researcher William Steinman in the 1980s. However, according to the Army, no records of this unit existed due to it existing only through institutional memory. Los Alamos, Sandia, and Lawrence Livermore are labs intimately entwined with UFO lore. Quite recently, I discussed provable subterranean facilities existing below Sandia and Los Alamos and their possible connection to UFO legacy programs. And one of NES partners, EG&G, really needs no introduction. This former contractor is infamous in UFO lore, serving as the contractor Bob Lazar claimed employed him to attempt to reverse engineer UFO propulsion devices at Area 51-S4. And EG&G's Nevada parking lot also served as the meeting place for the disputed but likely accurate 2002 Wilson-Davis meeting notes. Funny enough, NEST themselves in a 1995 NEST assessment team report stated, quote, "The laboratory program managers enjoy a relatively high degree of autonomy and independence with respect to focusing efforts and funding on those elements of their internal programs, which they have deemed to be the most important," end quote. This intriguing and free management style around NEST laboratories arose from the laboratory's heavy focus on research and development activities during formative years. Under Executive Order 12656, which created NEST, the primary authority to NEST was the 1954 Atomic Energy Act. Mention of the Atomic Energy Commission's Atomic Energy Act of 1954 should immediately set off alarm bells. This 1954 Act has been labeled specifically in the Schumer-Rounds legislation as a system for misclassifying UFO data and materials, historically misclassifying them as Transclassified Foreign Nuclear Information, or by the acronym TFNI. Whether the UFO Wagon encountered emitted signs of radiological signatures when tracked by laser strike radar or intelligence agency radars matters not, as UFO materials have historically been hidden within the exact 1954 Act that provided oversight to NEST. However, it is indeed possible this craft emitted signatures of interest to attract the eyes of the DOE. Recently, I covered a 1991 deep-sea UFO retrieval case in which a triangular craft that had sat on the sea for 30 or 40 years was recovered by a naval DSRV crew due to survey ships recognizing radioactive signatures from the seafloor. Further intriguing links exist between Jonathan's testimony and NEST. In February of 1997, just 1 to 2 months before Weygand's encounter, NEST introduced the JTOT, or Joint Technical Operations Team. This team aimed to provide deployable and technical operational support for NEST to DOD at even faster speeds than present NEST teams, and this team operated 365 days a year at 24 hours a day. Let's reference Diffusing Armageddon, Inside NEST, America's Secret Nuclear Bomb Squad by author Jeffrey T. Richelson, the same author of The U.S. Intelligence Community, that provided extremely valuable information on the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office. Around 1997, Russia blasted a probe from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, carrying the Mars 96 probe. The fourth stage of this proton rocket failed, leaving the rocket unable to escape Earth. Mars 96 did not carry an onboard nuclear reactor, but did in fact carry 18 small energy generators powered by plutonium-238. But this was enough to get NEST's attention. U.S. Space Command estimated the probe was large enough some pieces would survive re-entry, and the unlucky countries of origin were estimated to be Bolivia or Colombia. NEST debated deployment to Bolivia or Colombia, two countries considered quote-unquote not very important, but ceased action once surviving debris landed west of South America in the Pacific Ocean. What is interesting here is that the same year as Weygand's encounter, NEST considered deployment to recover a probe in countries neighboring Peru. NEST acted off intelligence gathered from U.S. Space Command and their Defense Support Program, DSP, satellites. And now, I have made an entire video on the subject of fastwalkers, a term used by US NORTHCOM and NORAD to designate any strange object leaving or entering Earth's atmosphere at incredible speeds. In the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign leaks, communications were found between Clinton campaign manager John Podesta and USG contractor Bob Fish. In these exchanges, Fish stated, quote, "One of the government programs that collects hard data on unidentified flying objects is the USAF DSP satellite program," end quote. In the same video, I covered an incredible DSP Fastwalker case relayed to journalist and former Army Criminal Investigation Command agent Joseph Stafula. This case allegedly saw a UFO traveling at 22,000 miles per hour towards Earth pass within 1.5 miles of a DSP satellite before changing course. And by the way, guess which U.S. agency has a history of developing and managing DSP satellites? Yes, the NRO, or National Reconnaissance Office. Remember from numerous projects of mine and the incredible articles of Chris Sharp, the NRO has been labeled time and time again as a Big Five U.S. intelligence agency that provides various forms of satellite intelligence for UFO domestic and foreign crash retrieval incidents. All this out of Jeffrey T. Richelson's work is to say that there are provable instances of DSP satellites and Nest working in conjunction the same year as Weygandt's testimony to cover debris in South America. I think for Weygandt's case, it is highly likely the NRO managed DSP satellites monitoring the egg-shaped crafts crashing in Peru and deployed a Nest rapid recovery unit to secure the site. What strengthens this thesis even more is the fact Weygandt himself mentioned a bunker below the laser strike radar station that was tracking UFOs. As we discussed, while performing perimeter security, Weygandt would state how he overheard USAF personnel discussing aircraft flying in and out of atmosphere at Mach 10 plus, or almost 7,700 miles per hour. Also recall how Weygandt mentioned US Army CH-47s deploying the DOE team. In a declassified 1995 Nest Assessment Team report, we can see the DOE ensured with the Department of Defense that suitable military aircraft would be made immediately available to support an emergency deployment of Nest forces and equipment. Nest also worked closely with the U.S. Naval Explosive Ordnance Disposal Technology Division and U.S. Army 52nd Ordnance Group. It is possible in this instance the CH-47 belonged to Nest Army partners. Indeed, the U.S. Army South did begin supporting counter-drug operations in South America in 1995 by providing aircraft such as four UH-60A or Blackhawks for such operations until 1 November 1997. But what I think here is that it's quite probable these Army CH-47s used to transport the Nest team were from the 1st Battalion 228th Aviation Regiment. 1228th Aviation is part of Joint Task Force Bravo, a U.S. Southcom forward-based expeditionary task force operating to promote stability and security by countering transnational threats, including narco traffic. Throughout the 90s, JTF Bravo conducted numerous missions in Central and South America and saw the U.S. Army 7th Special Forces we discussed earlier work alongside the 128th Aviation in support of the Peru-Ecuador 1995 border dispute. And interestingly enough, throughout the 90s, 1228th Aviation had headquartered in Panama and Honduras and featured a fleet of helicopters including CH-47 Chinooks. I do need to quickly mention we are faced with an additional possibility of the origin of these helicopters. As we move on to discuss the black operators in U.S. Special Forces, we must also discuss the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, a U.S. Army Special Forces special mission unit that provides helicopter aviation support for special operations forces. Nicknamed the Night Stalkers, the 160th often works with Joint Special Operations Command. The Night Stalkers are some of the Army's greatest qualified aviators, crew chiefs, and support soldiers and employ a massive fleet of helicopters, including numerous CH-47 Chinooks. The Night Stalkers have even deployed on several missions of interest here, including recovering a downed Soviet helicopter in June of 1988. Now, there is no record of the Night Stalkers performing operations in South America during the 1990s. In fact, closest we can get is deployment out of Panama for Operation Desert Storm in 91. Obviously, with Special Forces operations, there would likely be next to no record of covert activities by the 160th SOR in the region. But the reason I suspect the 128th Aviation from JTF Bravo CH-47 Chinooks were used over the highly qualified Special Operations Force, the Night Stalkers, is because of provable CH-47s existing under the 128th Aviation and Southcom's domain at the time of our crash retrieval incident. The Night Stalkers are stationed out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and it is technically impossible for the team to have flown Chinooks to Peru and commenced the operation in the roughly 9 hours we outlined for the DOE team. But this is all to say it is very possible elements of the Night Stalkers were stationed in Southcom's domain as part of a UFO rapid recovery team, especially if Laserstrike had already monitored numerous UFOs. But for now, we are forced to look at provable existing vehicles in the region that would satisfy the retrieval operation. And now this brings us to the armed men in black camis with no insignia. I do think we are faced with a few possibilities here. In the same 1995 NEST assessment team report, we can see NEST additionally worked alongside US Special Operations and US Navy Special Operations. I have often spoken and reflected on the work of excellent journalist Chris Sharp exposing the CIA's Office of Global Access. Born in 2003 out of the CIA Directorate of Science and Technology, the Office of Global Access, or OGA, was accused by Sharp as participating in foreign UFO crash recovery operations. While OGA provided operational logistics and intelligence agencies provided various forms of intelligence, Sharp labeled JSOC, or Joint Special Operations Command, as serving as the boots-on-the-ground force for such retrieval operations. And as we discussed earlier, Joint Special Operations Command is a subordinate command within Special Operations Command. Sharp, myself, and others have accused JSOC and thus SOCOM as participating directly in UFO crash retrievals. Interestingly, JSOC is comprised of the best of the best of U.S. Special Forces, Delta Force, SEAL Team 6, the 24th STS, Regimental Reconnaissance Company, and the Intelligence Support Activity. The Shadowy Intelligence Support Activity is often known as the most mysterious unit of JSOC. Task Force Orange, as it's sometimes referred to, was originally created under U.S. Army INSCOM, or Intelligence and Security Command. U.S. Army INSCOM was created under General Albert Stubblebine, a figure famous in UFO lore. Stubblebine showed keen interest in utilizing psi phenomena such as remote viewing for military usage and has also been accused by numerous individuals such as Philip J. Corso and Stephen Greer as participating directly in UFO legacy program operations at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. All this is to say, I do think it is highly likely Weygandt encountered unmarked SOCOM or JSOC units alongside the DOE NEST team. The question here is, were these units currently stationed in Peru for laser strike or deployed rapidly from a base similar to the DOE NEST crew? This is up for debate, but I do have my own strong thesis here. Let's break this down. Weygandt did state during his deployment performing perimeter security for Laserstrike, he did encounter Special Forces operators training. As a matter of fact, U.S. Special Forces were deployed to Peru during this time. Let us analyze a 1996 to 1997 document pulled from the Defense Technical Information Center titled The U.S. Military and Drug War in Peru. As we mentioned earlier, this document details 14 Special Forces counter-drug deployments to Peru conducted by U.S. Southcom or U.S. Southern Command. These forces would regularly engage in riverine training. As it turns out, and this will become extremely important soon, U.S. Southcom held the Marforlant Marine Forces Atlantic Riverine Training Team in Iquitos, Peru for utilization under Operation Laserstrike. Iquitos is a host to all sorts of U.S. military installations of interest we will touch on soon. Circling back, there is the Southcom unit deployed to Peru in 1997 we discussed earlier. I highly suspect did indeed intercept Weygandt and his fellow Marines and secured a UFO crash site. These being the U.S. Army 7th Special Forces Unit, aka the U.S. Army Green Berets. Due to their consistent execution of U.S. Southcom missions, including a historical presence training and countering narcotic distribution in Central and South America, especially in northern Peru, I wager here the Army 7th Special Forces were quote-unquote recruited by DOE NEST to serve as the enforcement arm of a UFO crash retrieval operation. Now, there is a secondary argument here of who these operators could be, far less likely in my opinion, but still worth exploring. This being the Department of Energy Special Response Team. These anti-nuclear terrorist teams are the DOE's own elite task force, an elite operator force entrusted with moving nuclear arsenals across the continental United States. The Special Response Team has arrest-on-site authority and at least in the 1980s donned all black camis similar to the outfits described by Weygandt. Historically, in the late 90s, DOE SRT units also provided security for sensitive DOE defense nuclear facilities, including Los Alamos National Labs and Lawrence Livermore National Labs. Sound familiar? These teams were trained by Wackenhut. Wackenhut was a private security company I have talked about extensively, had historically guarded USA legacy program sites through their industrial security expertise. Former CIA Director and Director of Naval Intelligence Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, who admitted to NASA mission specialist Bob Eschler, recovered UFOs may one day become available for scientific research, once served as chairman of Wackenhut. While I can find no data to suggest DOE SRTs have ever operated outside of the United States, it stands to reason such a team could travel with NEST assets to incredibly sensitive materials such as a crashed UFO protected by the 1954 Atomic Energy Agreement Act. After all our investigation into the team with Delta, Oscar, Echo on their protection suits and rain jackets, as well as the armed anonymous Americans in black camis, I think we can construct a powerful thesis. U.S. forces engaged in counter-narcotics reconnaissance systems for Operation Laser Strike monitored a UFO. In addition to radar, it is likely the Defense Support Program satellites run by the NRO either picked up the same UFO or elements of Laser Strike were also involved with the Defense Support Program. The UFO then crashed. In Wiegandt's estimate, this crash was caused, as we discussed earlier, by Peruvian Air Force surface-to-air Hawk MiM-23 missile batteries. From data gathered by intelligence sources, likely DSP with support from the NRO, a DOE NEST retrieval team was dispatched via internal NEST jet assets. With a point of origin in the mainland United States, the southernmost NEST facility here is Sandia National Labs in New Mexico. The NEST team either departed with a DOE Special Response Team, SRT, or leveraged Green Beret Special Forces assets to provide on-site protection for securing the crash zone. NEST also leveraged, per their DoD authority, several U.S. Army CH-47 Chinooks from either the 160th SOAR Night Stalkers or 1228th Aviation from JTF Bravo stationed nearby in U.S. Southcom territory. During the crash recovery and deployment of on-site directives, NEST and the first to arrived armed entourage encountered a group of Marines that had happened upon the crash site first. One Marine resisted detainment and was confined due to coming in contact with possibly hazardous materials leaking from the non-human craft. The young Marine was stripped of his contaminated clothes by NEST personnel in biohazard suits. Isolated from his fellow Marines and taken to a secure base with medical facilities for quarantine, interrogation, and debrief, the MACG-28 Marine was held in isolation for up to 48 hours, threatened repeatedly, and forced under fear of death to sign confidentiality agreements. The Marine was then driven back to his operational base, where he was soon forced to return to Cherry Point, North Carolina. Okay, now that we have outlined our thesis, let's step back and explore this piece by piece. We must start by analyzing where exactly was Jonathan Wiegandt stationed and where may have this crash occurred. Operation Laser Strike was conducted primarily in Pucallpa, Peru. However, there were two secondary locations that supported Operation Laser Strike and Peruvian counter-drug operations while also featuring TPS-43 radar systems within Iquitos and Andoas. Many familiar with the case of Wiegandt believes he was stationed at Pucallpa, the primary laser strike facility, and while this is indeed possible, I would like to propose a secondary possible station. Elements of laser strike are still classified to this day, and I know this because I've spoken to one of the Marines Wiegandt described he was with in his testimony. The Marine refused to discuss many details of laser strike with me since the operation was still classified. To me, this partially rules out Pucallpa as the base at which Jonathan, Allen, Adkins, and others were stationed, but why? Pucallpa, at least since 2001, has received public publicity as a laser strike location. One of the Marines I talked to's unwillingness to speak about their base of operations leads me to believe it was not Pucallpa. Furthermore, Wiegandt stated his unit flew into Lima, Peru via C-130, then took a multiple-hour flight with one stop to travel to their operational base. Jonathan was unaware of where exactly this location was, and Pucallpa is around 300 miles from Lima. At the cruise speed of a C-130, this journey from Lima to Pucallpa would take less than 1 hour. However, there was a laser strike location up north in Peru that existed more than 630 miles away from Lima. At a cruising speed, a C-130 would take near 2 hours to complete this journey. With an added stop, this satisfies our journey conditions of several hours. This laser strike location is USAF Detachment 5 in Iquitos, Peru. Detachment 5 is a very private installation I can only find one mention of in the 1990s or onward. Iquitos is home to USAF Radar Detachment 5, the Mar Forlant Riverine Training Team discussed earlier, and NAMRU 6, now called NAMRU South, aka the Navy Medical Research Unit. All three of these locations' significance will become apparent very soon, especially when Wigant discussed the facility he was taken to by the DOE team and the permanent structures there on site. Now, I can find next to no information about the Andoas laser strike site, but these aforementioned locations at Iquitos lead me strongly to believe Iquitos is the correct location. Wigant stated his radar station was tracking narcotics traffic from Bolivia. Analyzing narco routes from 1998, we can see drug transport routes passing directly through Iquitos, Peru. But let's go step by step through the incident and try to reconstruct Wigant's encounter. Jonathan was informed of a crashed aircraft near 11 p.m. to midnight. By 3 to 4 a.m., the Lance Corporal, Sergeant Adkins, Sergeant Allens, and multiple Marines and Humvees departed for the crash area. After a combination of driving and trekking, the Marines reached the crash area as the sun was rising around 6 to 7 a.m. What this means is that from the time the Marines left their base of operations, which I highly suspect is the enigmatic USAF Radar Detachment 5 in Iquitos, Peru, to the time the Marines got to the crash, only between 2 and 4 hours had elapsed. But let's break this down. Remember, Wigant claimed the Marines drove Humvees and trekked to the crash area. Wigant would also make mention that while he was analyzing the craft up close, he was incredibly sweaty, but made no mention of fatigue due to the hiking. While a Marine equipped with a full loadout and weapon would certainly get quite sweaty quickly in the Peruvian air. Average temperatures in March in Peru are only 77 degrees Fahrenheit, with the sunrise temp being much cooler. Due to these factors, we will take the average time elapsed to the crash site 3 hours and assume the Marines drove for 2.5 hours and trekked for 30 minutes. Humvees drive at max speeds of 70 miles per hour but operate conservatively, especially on jungle terrain and roads. Therefore, we will assume the caravan of Marines traveled at 35 miles per hour. At 2.5 hours of driving, this means if the Marines traveled in a straight line, the soldiers could have traveled near 88 miles. The average human hikes at roughly 2 to 3 miles per hour, and we will assume here trained soldiers who got a pep in their step could trek 2 miles in 30 minutes. With this information and a tremendous amount of error, and I fully understand my calculations are based on heavy assumptions, we can assume the crash occurred in a 90-mile radius outside of Iquitos. To try and correct for some of my error here, I will give a plus minus of 25% error. We are then left with this general area of where the crash may have occurred. Now recall, Wigant did say the crash occurred just over the border, but he stated the Bolivian border, specifically 5 to 10 miles from the Bolivian border. Now if Wigant's testimony is true, this means he either got the border of Bolivia incorrect, confusing the country with the borders of either Brazil or Colombia. Or he was stationed at a secretive location in southeast Peru that featured multiple camps and permanent structures. Now I tend to believe the former, and that Jonathan misspoke, as his laser strike installation was tasked with tracking Bolivian narco traffic, and Iquitos employed a significant amount of US DOD permanent structures and assets that line up with Jonathan's testimony and the timeline of events. What reinforces this thesis is the point we discussed earlier, that the U.S. Army 7th Special Forces and Joint Task Force Bravo, containing the 1st Battalion 228th Aviation Regiment, had historically conducted U.S. Southcom missions in northern Peru during the 1955 Peru-Ecuador border dispute. So it is interesting the men in black camis I wager were U.S. Army 7th Special Forces were already available to secure the crash site in northern Peru. Anyways, we can conclude from the exploration above, Wigant, Adkins, and the fellow Marines uncovered the crashed UFO 5 to 10 miles from either the Colombian or Brazilian border in one of these two general regions. Within 15 to 20 minutes of the Marines arriving, the crash site was secured by multiple U.S. Army CH-47 helicopters, DOE personnel, and armed men in black camis Wigant is certain arrived to the scene before the CH-47s.
It was almost like they were there already. They were on the ground already, and whoever was flying over was coming in after these guys had landed. So I'm not sure where they landed, where they were, but they were just there on top of us like within a few minutes.
And so
I can't remember exactly how.
It's speculation on your part. You don't know for sure, but you think it's possible that team may have been there first.
Yeah, they were definitely there first. And they were monitoring us too. I'm sure they knew we were in the area when we got up there near it. But they looked Army, but they didn't have, you know, insignia on them. Okay. Right? They were same color and all this.
From the data we've discussed above and involvement of NRO-managed DSP satellites, I wager this rapid reaction retrieval team had maybe 1 hour advance notice of the crash to the Marines. Therefore, let's assume this retrieval team had a maximum of 9 hours to gather intelligence, assemble, brief, and reach the crash site with a detailed operational plan. Remember, at this time, NES teams were historically stationed at U.S. Department of Energy laboratories. So I think it is extremely unlikely any team would have been stationed in South America at this time. In this instance, one of the closest major labs to Iquitos, Peru is a regular, tricky customer of this channel, Central New Mexico's Sandia National Labs. And recall back to discussing NEST, in the 1996 NEST briefing, NEST was not only permitted to commandeer any DoD assets, but also employed their own fleet of vehicles, including Cessna Citation II jets. So my theory here would see a NEST team departing Sandia, heading directly to Iquitos U.S. military infrastructure via Cessna Citation II jets. From Iquitos or nearby Southcom installations, the team would commandeer US CH-47 helicopters, likely from Joint Task Force Bravo, and recruit nearby special forces from the Riverine training team, or utilize a JSOC or DOE SRT team that traveled with the NEST team. Sandia's nearby largest city is Santa Fe, New Mexico, and using Santa Fe as a reference point, travel distance to Iquitos is 3,446 miles. A Cessna Citation II travels at top speed of 464 miles per hour. Logically assuming the team wished to arrive to the retrieval site with haste, this flight would have taken around 7.5 hours. From Iquitos, the team would have a very short flight to arrive to the crash area around 90 to 100 miles away in a CH-47 that travels 180 to 196 miles per hour at top speed. So this journey here, on the shorter end, would have taken roughly 30 minutes. This means the NEST team would have only required around 8 hours total of travel time, with roughly 1 hour left for personnel and gear gathering, necessary ground briefings, etc. A tight squeeze, but one that very well fits in the framework of Weygandt's testimony.
And then they took me in the CH-47, and they sent me to, we took off, and they didn't drug me or anything like that, and I was just awake there. And they had me in a, your question again is, how long was I contained or subdued? I don't know, for about 2 days, I think. I don't know. I didn't know where I was. Because we landed, and we flew, and then we landed, and then they took me out, and it was still, I mean, you know, it wasn't in the same area that I was at. This is more of like there were structures, permanent structures there. I think it was Peruvian military. But all this thing, man, all I saw there was Americans, and there's a lot of other nationalities there, Chinese, Germans, I think, were there, and I mean, a lot of other people were at this other base. But I mean, this thing was really, I mean, I didn't go in, and all they did was take me to like a, you couldn't call it a cell. It was more of like a, it was more like an interrogation room. And I sat in there for, I don't know, 15 hours.
Lance Corporal Weygandt was isolated from Adkins, Allen, and the other Marines. He was flown to a location that was not his base of operations, which I wager was in Iquitos. Now, what's interesting is this location was close enough to his original station that after 1 to 2 days of captivity, Weygandt was driven back before being kept with USAF personnel for 3 weeks. Another nod towards Iquitos being the correct location with USAF Detachment 5 before being shipped back to Cherry Point. At this interrogation room, Weygandt was contained, isolated, and threatened by some of the operators in black camis, and was then forced to sign documents swearing his silence by a USAF colonel. Describing this location, Weygandt made a very interesting set of remarks. The location at which he was interrogated employed permanent structures, not makeshift forward operating bases like Pucallpa laser strike location. It was at this base where he was interrogated he observed multiple different nationalities in one area: Americans, Peruvians, Chinese, and Germans. also recall twice Weygandt got the mysterious liquid leaking from the craft on him, once during his initial investigation of the crash site and a second time when the black operators forcefully took him to the ground. Weygandt also stated here the DOE team in hazmat gear stripped his clothes covered in the liquid. Due to these statements, plus Weygandt being isolated from Adkins and Allen, I do think it likely the DOE Nest team had concerns Weygandt was contaminated from interacting with the liquid. For this reason, I do have high suspicion Weygandt was taken to NAMRU 6, or NAMRU South, the Navy Medical Research Unit with offices in Lima, Peru, and Iquitos. The U.S. Navy employs various NAMRU locations around the globe which serve as DOD laboratories and centers. NAMRU SA at Joint Base San Antonio, Texas, NAMRU 3, formerly in Egypt, now in Sigonella Naval Air Station, Sicily, Italy, NAMRU Indo-Pacific in Singapore Naval Base, NAMRU South, with offices in Lima and Iquitos, Peru, and NAMRU D at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. NAMRU locations absolutely fit the dictionary definition of multicultural environments. NAMRU installations serve as a network of biomedical research labs operated by the U.S. Navy. NAMRU operates to conduct R&D on infectious diseases, biodefense, and numerous medical topics related to military and public health. NAMRU is part of the Navy Medical Research Command that conducts biomedical research to meet the needs of the Navy and Marine Corps. German nationalists at specifically NAMRU South are also not uncommon. Even in 2023, we can find examples of German military and ambassadors visiting NAMRU's Lima location. In my opinion, NAMRU would serve as a perfect location for Jonathan to be taken. This location is within driving distance to Iquitos USAF Detachment 5 and close to the U.S. Marforlant Riverine Training Team. And obviously, this location is a sensible holding and quarantine zone for a U.S. Marine who is exposed to possibly toxic materials in non-human craft. Now I do need to mention, of course, this theory is not without its own kinks. Weygandt stated he was only at this location for 2 days, and while he was contained in an interrogation-type room, he was still in close proximity to the USAF Lieutenant Colonel that forced him to sign papers and the operator who threatened his life. One might assume Weygandt would have had to be quarantined for up to a week in isolation and would have had to undergo numerous medical procedures to determine if any risk of sickness or contamination resided from the fluid. And Weygandt did specifically tell me he did not have to undergo any sort of medical procedures at this location. Other factors at play do need to be worked through for this NAMRU theory, such as the multinationals Jonathan described being armed operators and not diplomats, as well as this holding location being underground. Remember, this crash occurring near Iquitos is just a theory of mine constructed from the best available evidence for this crash retrieval testimony. But even so, I do believe Iquitos, Peru serves as the primary focus for our UFO crash retrieval and forced holding of Lance Corporal Jonathan Weygandt. I have contacted countless individuals named by Weygandt or possibly involved in this crash retrieval case. These include multiple USAF personnel from Iquitos Detachment 5, including Lieutenant Colonel Gayla Biles, 2nd Lieutenant Randall Rothman, and Staff Sergeant Robert McCoud of the 649th Combat Logistics Support Squadron. This outreach was conducted in an attempt to identify if Iquitos was indeed where Weygandt was stationed. I plan to inquire if U.S. Marines from the MAC-G28 performed perimeter security for the site. If a DOE team ever stationed briefly at Detachment 5 or borrowed their aircraft, or if stories floated around of a Marine who went missing that turned up 2 days later. As of today, I have had no luck contacting any USAF personnel involved in Laserstrike. Due to repeatedly hearing that some details of the op are still classified, I am not holding my breath. However, I will continue to pursue any and all leads. Jonathan Weygandt did directly state a Staff Sergeant Montalegre knew about the crash site and that Sergeant Allen and Sergeant Adkins had both accompanied Weygandt to the site and observed the crashed egg. With 100% confidence, I have identified all three of these men, and all three are real USMC veterans and enjoyed long accomplished careers with the Corps after Laserstrike. And I reached out to all three on multiple platforms, and as of this date, only one Marine has responded. I choose to keep the identity of this Marine anonymous out of respect to the individual and to his service to the United States. I will also refrain from posting screenshots, as I do not wish to break this individual's trust, nor do I have his permission to do so. I reached out to these Marines from this channel's email address, uapgerb@gmail.com, which I highly encourage any firsthand UFO legacy program witnesses to contact. This email does not contain my identity to protect my anonymity. I emailed one of these sergeants asking to talk to him about his service during laser strike in 1996 to 1997. I did also state that my outreach concerned an encounter relayed by a MAC G-28 Lance Corporal, but withheld Weygandt's name, who claimed he, alongside a handful of sergeants, encountered a unique downed aircraft. The sergeant responded hello and addressed me, Gerb, by both my first and my last name. In this exchange, the sergeant continued, quote, "The operation is still classified. However, there was no incident involving a unique downed aircraft that I know of or encountered during my deployment. I can speak to what never happened during my deployment and not cross the classification restrictions of the operation," end quote. The sergeant reckoned I had received bad intel regarding his involvement in the suggested incident I was pursuing. I then asked the Marine if he had ever heard of a Lance Corporal's testimony of a crashed egg-shaped vehicle that involved several other Marines that may have been downed by human military assets such as Hawk MiM-23 missile batteries. The Marine responded he was aware of a Lance Corporal Weygandt that served under his platoon. Much of this response by the sergeant focused on Hawk surface-to-air missile systems and the impossibility that the USMC employed a Hawk battery during 1997. And of course, Weygandt does agree with this point. Hawk missile batteries were phased out of US forces in 1994. The Marine Corps continued usage until 2002, but Laser Strike ceased usage of Hawk in 1997. Since his original testimony, Weygandt only theorized that this craft had been hit by a Hawk system and that the missile battery likely belonged to local Peruvian forces. And Weygandt held this theory due to the ballistic and fragging pattern of damage on the egg-shaped craft. Weygandt spent a tremendous amount of time studying Hawk MiM-23 systems and maintains this conclusion to this day. The sergeant not only claimed Weygandt never deployed in support of Operation Laser Strike, but also stated Weygandt's story was false, and while he was a good, young, respectful, obedient, and dedicated Marine, he also suffered a medical condition, quote, "He was never a participant in any clandestine operations or efforts. He was just an LAAD Marine, and that was all," end quote. Now, let me be clear here. I fully respect this Marine in question. After all, he dedicated much of his life to the service of this country, but I do have quite a few problems here with his statements. Jonathan Weygandt never once claimed to participate in any clandestine operations. This encounter simply involved a group of MAC G-28 Marines sent out by their radar detachment to secure the LZ of a downed aircraft. The MAC G-28 Marines in this testimony clearly conflicted with the clandestine mission of the DOE NEST team. I also find the claims Weygandt never deployed to Laser Strike to be quite curious. Laser Strike was indeed a classified mission. The Marine I spoke to claimed Weygandt may have picked up bits and pieces of deployment information from Marines that did indeed deploy to Laser Strike, but I find this unlikely. In Weygandt's testimony, and all the way back to his initial outreach to Stephen Greer on 1 August 2000, the young Lance Corporal described Operation Laser Strike extremely accurately, and the only detail that stands out as odd is how Jonathan claimed his USAF radar base was near the Bolivian border. I still maintain he likely meant Iquitos, near the Colombian and Brazilian borders. MAC G-28 Marines from Jonathan's U.S. station, Cherry Point, North Carolina, did absolutely deploy to Laser Strike. This is a fact. I find it odd Weygandt would not have deployed with the other MAC G-28 Marines for perimeter defense and low-altitude aerial defense to replace the obsolete Hawk batteries. Similar to hit pieces on David Grush, I also have a tremendous issue when claims of witnesses or whistleblowers are dismissed because of quote-unquote health conditions. Jonathan has been plain this incident affected his life extremely negatively. From the violent interrogation to feeling like non-human beings were calling out for his help in the craft wreckage, Jonathan did not leave this incident unscathed in the slightest. I must interject my own personal biases here, but I am close friends with Mr. Weygandt. The man enjoys a successful career and relationships with friends, family, and loved ones. As far as I can tell, the man does not suffer from fanciful delusions to construct such a specific fantasy. Since the witness testimony of Jake Barber, the concept of egg-shaped UFO retrievals has grown significantly in popularity. While Weygandt described a much larger, more intricate craft with hatches, a band of light along its circumference, and what seemed similar to gills over Barber's SUV-sized smooth white egg, we can find multiple retrieval cases from history that share numerous similarities to the alleged crash in Peru in 1997. Let's reference the work done by legendary UFO crash retrieval researcher Leonard Stringfield and visit UFO Crash Retrieval Status Report 3. Between 1980 and 1982, Stringfield became aware of one H.J., a sergeant in the U.S. Army 24th Infantry who was wounded during service in the Korean War. In July of 1953, whilst a private in B Company at Camp Polk, Louisiana, a 17-year-old private H.J. and his unit under command of one Sergeant R.S. were performing duty maneuvers. At dusk, at roughly 7 p.m., H.J.'s platoon observed an object that was egg-shaped crash land out in the boondocks. According to H.J., authorities as well as A and B companies were ordered out to the crash site. At the site, H.J. got within 15 yards of the object before Lieutenant Whitting ordered Company B to withdraw to 100 yards, stating quote-unquote peons like H.J., quote, had to get out of the way, end quote. Interestingly enough, we can place an actual Lieutenant Whitting at Camp Polk at this time. The area around the craft was badly burned, turning nearby ground into a powdery substance like crushed brick, and H.J. could still feel heat emanating from the vehicle. The craft was as wide as a three-bedroom single-story ranch house, which by modern standard estimates could be anywhere between 35 to 70 feet. Similarities here exist to Weygandt's craft estimates of 20 meters or roughly 66 feet. The large ovoid object was without windows or lights and, quote, was surrounded by a fin-like protrusion on its equator which was still rotating, end quote. Another close similarity to Weygandt and discussion of a band of light traveling across the craft's circumference. Shortly after securing the site, a special detachment, medics, an ambulance, and special equipment arrived on scene. This detachment approached an open hatch on the side of the craft. After a while, two medics carried away a stretcher to the ambulance containing a body. Three occupants of the craft then emerged and were aided by medics seemingly injured. H.J. would state, quote, "One of them kept looking at the one in the litter and made strange noises. I couldn't believe what I was seeing," end quote. As incredible as this detail is, we have discussed similar testimony before. Remember back to the infographic show whistleblower testimony of a crash retrieval operator I put a lot of stock into. The witness in this program claimed in several UFO retrieval operations in which craft were manned by biologics. Retrieval teams would often have to lead occupants out of the craft. These biologics were described seemingly as limited in cognitive ability. Possibly giving some credence to the theory, some UFO occupants are akin to biological androids that perform basic or specific functions.
That night, the two live ones apparently just kind of stood there as the team entered the craft. It had opened on its own. Maybe they opened the door. I don't know if it was open when we got there. They stood there, and they didn't answer the ambassador at all. Basically, they just barely reacted to anything. Just basic stimuli, like turning their heads away from bright lights. They didn't even object when the medical team started looking them over for injuries, or so I was told. I saw them when they were led out of the craft, and I do mean they were led out like children. The medical guys grabbed them by the hand and just led them out like a kid. They just sort of stood where you left them.
H.J. described these occupants as 3.5 to 4 feet tall, of slight build, and walked as if they had no knees or very stiff bending only at the hips. H.J. described large heads without features, leading him to believe the creatures were covered by a helmet. The biologics were a tight-fitting, dull metallic green uniform. Later on, H.J. would somehow learn that these biologics were sent to a hospital and quote-unquote put into isolation, but all died in captivity. He also learned the corpses were sent over to a medical center near Washington, D.C. This could, of course, perhaps be the Army's Fort Detrick, roughly 40 miles away from D.C., At Fort Detrick, Battelle Memorial Institute manages the National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasure Center, FFRDC. I have previously implicated Fort Detrick alongside Utah's Dugway Proving Ground in holding UFO biologics. I highly recommend checking out my video on Dugway to learn more. HJ's experience at Fort Polk shares striking similarities to Weygandt, but let's go even further. Let's now jump to Stringfield's 1991 UFO crash retrievals, The Inner Sanctum, Status Report 6, and investigate the case of Barnabas, aka Albert Bruce Collins. Much of Stringfield's work here came from UFO researcher Tim Cooper, one of the primary researchers who received significant drops of Majestic 12 documents in the 1980s. Also recall from my Majestic 12 project with author Ryan Wood how Tim Cooper's father, USAF Master Sergeant Harry B. Cooper, received a special citation from the legendary general entwined in UFO lore Curtis E. LeMay. This letter to Tim Cooper's father from LeMay praised Harry B. Cooper for his work on the quote-unquote USAF UFO program. Anyways, Cooper interviewed Barnabas, aka Albert Bruce Collins, shortly before his 1990 New Year's Eve death on 20 November 1990. Collins claimed to be a metallurgical engineer and retired government employee, specifically developing metal alloys used for electromagnetic propagation and magnetic field propulsion from 1942 to the late 1950s. And it is important to note, I can't necessarily confirm Collins' claims of an accomplished metallurgical engineering career. While Collins did in fact die on 30 December 1990, all I can confirm from his obituary is he was a veteran, a member of the NRA, and a nature conservancy. Collins disclosed to Cooper in 1947 he observed a UFO on a long flatbed trailer covered with a green tarp being backed into a large warehouse at the University of California, Berkeley. I'm immediately reminded of U.S. Army lowboy trucks described in numerous UFO retrieval cases such as the 1953 Kingman crash and the 1965 Kecksburg, Pennsylvania crash. According to Collins, he stood but just 100 feet away from an oval-shaped craft, described like an egg with the shell cracked and the yolk still inside. The craft was metallic, similar to polished aluminum, with a silvery-looking finish. Similar to Weygandt's case, this egg featured a seam at the edge, all the way around. Collins guessed this craft suffered an internal explosion, with the metal exterior of the craft seemingly pushed out. The retrieval had sustained significant amounts of damage, with a large section ripped off and a huge gash on top running down the side below the seam. From his 100-foot-away vantage point, Collins observed a bulkhead in front with multi-layered honeycomb skin. The interior was dark, but similar to the egg analogy, there was a shiny sphere in the center of the craft surrounded by another bulkhead. The craft additionally featured a forward compartment, but Collins could not see inside. The vehicle was 30 to 40 feet in diameter and roughly 15 feet high. These dimensions are slightly smaller than the craft Weygandt described. But why even mention this short story of Collins with no supporting documentation or even verification of his work history as a metallurgical engineer? Well, this is because in his 1990 interview with Tim Cooper, Collins additionally disclosed some information that may just raise your eyebrow. Not only did Collins claim to have studied metal of unknown composition and origin in an official capacity, but also claimed at this time, 1949, he learned of a multitude of agencies involved in TUO or Technologies of Unknown Origin research. This included intelligence offices from the U.S. Army, Air Force, and Navy, the CIA, the RAND Corporation founded just 1 year prior in 1948, and the Vatican. Collins even claimed to have learned of multiple projects between these agencies, Archangel between the CIA, RAND, and Vatican, Black Book under the Air Force, the infamous Blue Book under the Air Force, White Book between the CIA and Vatican, and Yellow Book, which served as a scientific panel of an unknown government scientific review board. While discussing these projects, Collins added he had heard Los Alamos National Labs had been studying green fireballs and strange debris found in the desert. And this last piece of data is what lends credence to some of Collins' words. As the Atomic Energy Commission did indeed create a Project Twinkle in the late 40s and early 50s that analyzed UFOs, including green fireballs at Los Alamos, Sandia, White Sands, and Holloman Air Force Base. Of course, this isn't our topic for today, but these joint projects with the Vatican are highly interesting. I have covered this case before, but let's briefly circle back to the 1933 Magenta, Italy UFO crash retrieval case. According to the case, as well as David Grush and the late Harold Malmgren, Vatican intelligence alerted the United States of the lenticular disc in Axis possession. This in turn allowed the US to capture this UFO saucer post-World War II. It's incredible to then consider joint US-Vatican UFO programs that followed World War II. Collins is quite the enigma, and possibly in the future, we will return to analyze further claims of his included knowledge in Project Archangel that determined some UFO occupants were biological extraterrestrials. There are many cases of egg-shaped or teardrop-shaped UFO retrieval operations we just don't have the time to cover today. I would also like to point to the 1973 Great Lake Naval Base RK testimony I covered in my previous Naval UFO Legacy Programs project, in which gunnery school instructor RK observed a 30-foot-long and 10-foot-high teardrop-shaped UFO resting on a wooden platform in a Quonset-style hangar in the Great Lakes Naval Station, Illinois. This craft was allegedly shot down via a naval destroyer and picked up in the Pacific Ocean by the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office's Glomar Explorer.
Hey guys, it's Grib, and I'd like to thank each and every single one of you for joining me on this very special investigation into Lance Corporal Jonathan Wagan. Now, those of you new to my videos will now know, one, this is an AI, and two, this is where after the video I kind of do an off-script kind of rant, if you want to call it, and give my thoughts on the video, give my thoughts on the investigation, and kind of summarize everything we've talked about. Returning viewers of this channel will probably know this is a very special video, as one of my first ever projects was on Jonathan Wagant. But of course, at that time, I didn't know Jonathan, I didn't have a relationship with him, nor did I have the investigative skills, the video editing skills, the research skills, the writing skills to craft such a project. Now, originally the plan here was just to do an interview with Wagant. And so after many months of knowing him and forming a friendship, I went out to where he resides. I'm not going to go ahead and spill that, but it's in the South, as you can probably tell from his accent, some of the other accents we heard. And I was fortunate enough to have my friend Kermit, Frog and Badger. I've had him on a live before, right after the November 14th, 2024 hearings. He was able to meet me out there and help film and so forth. So I want to give a huge shout out to him, guys. He's a great friend of this channel. I'd like to have him on some more lives. He just, on the drop of a pencil, decided to come up and help. So huge shout out. But this originally was planned to just be an interview with Wagant. And as he and I started talking, and as I started to sit with some of our conversations, I thought, well, maybe let's break this down a little bit and do a two-part series. First, Wagant back in 2000 gave so much information, really actionable information, down to the DOE Nest team due to names. And you guys know on this channel how much we love when names are given. And back in 2023, he offered little new information. So I thought, why don't Jonathan and I sit down and really iron out some of the finer details of what he remembers? Because guys, time is slipping away. This incident occurred, according to Jonathan, in 1997. So we're pushing on 30 years here. But I wanted to get some of those details out and work out an investigation and then sit down and do an interview with Jonathan. You guys know how I work. I really want the firm foundation laid out before he and I sit down and talk. So I do plan on returning with him and kind of getting a more relaxed interview style of him just speaking about his life before and after and so forth. So that's going to be coming down the pipeline. But this project, I thought it pertinent to start digging into some of the details with Jonathan and then be able to do my own research and exploration. Some of these added details included Jonathan describing that the Men in Black camis were there on site first. That was a huge question I had going into this, whether to kind of ponder if that team arrived on the CH-47s with the DOE Nest, probably, team, or that they had arrived first. Now, the fact they arrived first, according to Jonathan, gives even more credence to these were local special forces. Now, of course, he didn't describe seeing any vehicles, but in my opinion, the 7th, Army Green Berets probably utilized Humvees or nearby vehicles to arrive on scene first. Another key point here was the multinational group that these Germans, these Chinese, they were all armed. Now that is a massive detail as well, and one that I'm still trying to solve here, because of course we've heard of multinational recovery teams, specifically with Five Eyes Nations and Canadian politician Larry Maguire kind of writing to his own Minister of Defense in Canada saying, we need to get information about UAP because of Five Eyes projects and maybe retrieval teams. And another huge detail he talked about was him thinking the Men in Black camis were Army due to the helmets they had. Now, if you're unfamiliar with military, various factions of military, Army, Marines, Navy, all of their infantry and soldiers utilize different helmets. So being able to track down the helmets or kind of the caps they had, Wagant thought these guys were Army. And that's a huge detail to try and track down. I also really enjoyed him talking about mop gear and varying levels of that, and that gives even more credence to me for the Nest team, varying levels of protection versus how close in proximity these men would get to the craft. Now, Jonathan's testimony is, of course, truly startling. One of the big questions remains now is what happened to the craft after? And Jonathan and I talked about this. I decided not to include it here because it's speculation with very little basis here. But that's a very interesting question to me. This craft was lodged into a granite cliff face almost. How was it taken out? How was it retrieved? Because if we're talking about CH-47s and the Night Stalkers, sure, they may have airlifted some kind of picked apart Soviet helicopters before. But how do you get a craft of non-human origin, a massive one? And what are some of the logistics here? Were the biologics taken out first? Was the rest of the liquid contained and then taken out? And what went on here? And I do think one of the interesting parts of this story is the liquid. Now, as we dug into it, Jonathan and myself, he kind of theorized that, you know, maybe this liquid wasn't just a fuel, a propulsion system, but he thought because some liquid was coming out of the recessed hole, the hatch that was open where he saw the biologic hanging out, that water was coming from there, that this craft may have been filled with water. And that brings up the question, what if the species he encountered were almost an aquatic species that lived in the water, and the craft contained almost an aquarium or a closed system of water of sorts? I think these questions are highly interesting to ponder. I think one of the most fruitful and frustrating avenues of this research was reaching out to the fellow Marines, Atkins, Allen, and Montalegre. Total, I probably reached out to 10 people connected with Laser Strike. Only one responded to me, and that was one of the Marines that Weygandt claimed he was with. Now, it is important to note here, all three of those Marines, Montalegre, Allen, and Atkins, all went career USMC. They all retired enlisted, but it retired with very prestigious positions in Marines. I'm not saying there's a connection there, but it is interesting to see that Jonathan kind of got made an example of and left the Marines in 98, admitted to using controlled substances so he could get out of the Marines. But these other guys enjoyed very long careers. Now, the one that responded to me, again, I'm not going to burn his name just because unlike Brad S. in the Flux Liner, he hasn't sent me death threats, so I'm not going to burn his name or post any sort of screenshots and messages. But I was a little displeased with how he treated Jonathan. I said in the video, and I'll say it again, I don't think that whistleblower testimony should be kind of boiled down to saying that the witness just has mental issues. I've seen it before. I'm sure we'll see it again. This reminds me to the team leader of Michael Herrera, Nathan, who just said that Michael was crazy because he enjoyed lifting weights and spending time alone whilst deployed. And I find arguments like that to not have much in them. Now, I would always find it weird when contacting this Marine, most of his story would go just towards the impossibility of USMC having Hawk batteries in Peru at that time. And I agree with that. Jonathan agrees with that. But he always said, no, the story's false. The story can't be true because we didn't have Hawk batteries. The Lance Corporal story is false. So that's kind of a mute point to me. But I also think it's strange he said that Jonathan never deployed to Pucallpa or to Laser Strike when MACG 28 Marines, very well indeed, according to our Laser Strike documentation, did deploy. So that's a bit of a curious point. Now, of course, I try and be as objective as I can in my videos, but in the end of my videos, I tend to give my opinion. Guys, I do believe the encounter of Jonathan Weygandt, and I believe it for a couple reasons, not just talking to Jonathan, but talking to kind of people not connected with this. I do have conviction that this case is real. I think it's one of the most extraordinary encounters of a downed UFO craft of all time. That being said, there's still mysteries here with this case. Of course, time's slipping away, so Jonathan is remembering fewer and fewer details, and I commend him for being able to say when he doesn't remember, because this was 30 years ago, and as impactful as such an event would be, there are going to be things he can't quite remember, like insignias on people's uniforms, or tiny little details of the makeup of notches on a craft, or the digits on an arm hanging out. These things I don't blame him for being able to recall, and I commend him for saying, I'm speculating here, or I don't recall when he doesn't know something. But I do think this is a case that did occur. What happened to the craft? We could only guess. Did it get taken to the Office of Naval Research? Because I suspect NAMRU South had some sort of implications here. Was there transfer of materials or liquid up to Namru up in Wright-Patterson? Who knows? And that being said, my theory of Namru and my theory of Iquitos and my theory of the Seventh, this does still need work. I think it's a strong thesis, but of course we can't concretely prove this. The biggest hiccup here is, of course, Namru being the location where Weygand was held versus him not receiving any medical treatment. I do think this interesting that the DOE personnel probably Nest. You know, I think at this point it's almost a mute point to try and argue that it's not Nest, but he was stripped of his clothes. Clearly his clothes were taken off as soon as he encountered the liquid when he was beaten by the other Marines, separated from Adkins and Allen. Who knows what happened to them? Who knows what happened to the 7+ other Marines that were not in the Vanguard, that may have seen the craft, that may have not made it down the ridge? Weygand doesn't know. And he was put into isolation, threatened, and so on. So I think because he took a swing at one of these men, he was both made an example of, and because he encountered the liquid, there was a contamination threat. But he didn't receive medical procedures. Is this a substance that the DOE Nest team and retrieval teams are familiar with? And maybe it's just like a slightly acidic, goopy water with the consistency of syrup. So they weren't really worried, but they wanted to get those clothes off. And maybe, but that's all just speculation. So is Namru. But I do think that kind of fits the bill for a Marine that came into contact with a non-human fluid. Get him isolated. But again, he said this location was underground. Perhaps Namru has underground facilities. Perhaps this was nearby. And I do think it's interesting he was driven back to his base. Now, I need to get in contact with somebody else stationed at Raider Detachment 5, which I really have tried to see if there were MACG-28 Marines there, because this would really solve quite a bit of this. But I do think it's interesting with the Mar Forlint training team and the Special Forces there, and all of the history of Special Forces, whether that be the 1st 228th Aviation Regiment or the 7th Special Forces up there in northern Peru in history. Now, of course, this retrieval team could be a dedicated JSOC or former JSOC or SOCOM retrieval team that's stationed in South America, maybe Howard Air Force Base and Panama, maybe somewhere else to react to these. And this would fit in our time frame of retrieval too, because I know I gave about 9 hours. It could be plus or minus an hour even to that. I have a lot of error here. They could be stationed for South American retrievals. We just don't know. I'm just trying to work with the best available evidence we have and try and reconstruct the testimony. So, of course, in my theory, there's a lot of assumptions there. And I was the first to say that there's a lot of assumptions. And if you have a competing theory of how this played out, please let me know. I'd love to hear it, because at the end of the day, I'm just trying to take some of the pieces of evidence and fit them into a theory. And I do think it's strong, but it is open to interpretation and probably open to error. So if you have something better there or something you think is stronger, let me know. I'd love to talk more about this case. Speaking of, let me know what you guys think in the comments, because I know so many people have wanted to hear more from Weygand, and I'm thrilled this has some exclusive conversations with him for the first time really in since 2000, because on the Martin Willis show, he didn't really shed new light on any details. I almost got the sense he didn't quite want to be there. So I was really glad Weygand and I could form a friendship and then kind of sit down on camera together. And he was really nervous about being on camera. He doesn't like it. He's a very different person on camera versus not on camera. It makes him very uncomfortable. He's a very private guy, always has been. He was very animated in 2000, and it took him a lot to get over the fear of going on camera then, took him a lot of fear going on camera in 2023 and now. So with that being said, guys, this is about the time I tell everybody, of course, I do have a Patreon. I don't gatekeep any content. There's no extra content on there. I don't have time to make extra content. Everything I make is open source and will always be freely available. I will never gatekeep research. I will never gatekeep projects. So if you want to support the channel, just support what you think the channel is worth. What doesn't cost you money is to like and subscribe. Please do that. Leave a comment. That helps the channel out tremendously. These investigations take quite a while, as we found out here, with about a week extra over my normal timetable of when I release videos. So please support the channel however you can. And I got some great stuff coming down the pipeline, some active stuff whenever there's hearings, if those happen. And whenever there's large events, you bet I will be there, and you bet I will do a live covering them, because I do not just want to be an armchair investigator. I want to get boots on the ground and do what I can to help this subject and help push for some semblance of disclosure. So again, guys, like and subscribe if you want. Support the Patreon. Leave a comment. Let me know what you think below, and I will catch everybody on the next episode. Thank you so very much for joining me. Goodbye, everybody.